In the second part of this interview with Steve Wilcox, Richard Marks gets to grips with Steve's understanding of the correct description of common statistical processes. What precisely is fusion, and how does it differ from imputation, from ascription? And what do we understand of blind matching? Enjoy.
So now I'm something of a pedant when it comes to getting into debates about how you describe certain elements of research and statistics. And you're going to be giving a paper in Nice, based around the work that you've been doing in Italy, looking at a 7-meter panel and a people meter panel, which I don't want to preempt, but one of the important things about that paper and the other papers we have is that we get our terminology correct. And one of the strengths that people often point to in your position in the industry, you're simultaneously, you know, a guru when it comes to statistics, but you're also very good at describing to normal people what you're doing. So fusion is obviously a word that's being thrown around, and I suspect being used to apply to a lot of things that aren't technically fusion. So how would you define the word fusion to the layman? What is a fusion and what isn't a fusion?
Okay. First of all, I think it's probably best that I think I have to declare that I'm not a pedant in this respect. And this is because I think that the objectives and the techniques can be mixed and matched. And when I say matched, there's no pun intended there. But anyway, let me have a go at this. I must admit, I tried to rely on looking things up in Wikipedia and didn't get very far there. So these are my own interpretations, honestly. But if we start with respondent-level data fusion, it's where you've got a situation where you've got two independent samples which you hope represent the same universe. They have different survey subjects. So one might be TV and one might be product purchasing. But there's some common information between the two, which we call fusion hooks. That might be demographics, for example. And then from those two data sets, we have to decide which individuals are the most similar. So taking one from each of the data sets. And we simply, having done that, very simple, we just merge their survey records. And the idea is that this looks exactly like a single source survey. So that's respondent-level data fusion, and I'd like to call it a stratified sampling technique from one survey.
So what would be recent examples of that level of activity you've been involved in?
Touch points is the most notable, and we certainly don't confine ourselves to respondent-level fusion or touch points. It really depends what data's coming in. So you mentioned JITREG, for example. That can't be respondent-level fusion, because that's not how the data is put out there. But if you're talking about Bar, Brajar, the NRS for readership, they're all examples of respondent-level fusion.
So that's two independent respondent-level data sets without a point of overlap between them.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. Then I wanted to move on to imputation, because you've mentioned this. An imputation is a situation where you've got missing items in a survey, so particular respondents haven't given an answer to a question, or you've got whole data points that are missing, so a particular respondent hasn't given you any answers, but you feel the need to create a representative sample to fill the gaps in. And the idea is that there you're actually modelling survey responses from the survey data that is complete and the information that you might have apart from the missing data point. And you're looking at patterns across the whole sample, and you can use that to impute an answer to a question. It can be the real reason for doing that is to create a representative and convenient sample base.
So it's a bit like a dentist filling in some missing teeth to give you a full gleaming set of...
And making sure it's the same size, if you like, and in the right place. And of course you can use data fusion to solve that problem, or data fusion technique. And that's exactly what happens with the Bar Lifestyle Insight Survey, where a only 70% of people respond to the survey, and we fill the rest in with an imputation or data fusion technique. So there's the mixing and matching thing.
So but last year at ASI, we had a paper from AGF in Germany about how they were effectively taking data from 15 to 24s with good compliance and applying it to poor compliant 15 to 24s to basically, you know, get themselves a better data set. That, to me, that would be imputation.
I think that's right, yes. Yeah. And I, you know, it's a very difficult subject. And I'm always worried if people are not actually measuring things and making things up, even though that's exactly what I do most of the time. If it's controlled, and I'm sure it will be, a great solution.
Yeah, very promising. The other thing that it's also done a fair amount is blind matching, which is when you're involving companies like Experian and so on, sort of third parties. I mean, do you want to talk a bit more about how that's probably an outlier in terms of what RSMB does, but it's increasingly being used to bring data sets together, isn't it?
I'm really glad you've asked about that, because I don't know much about it. But so I think...
Well, that's the whole point, is blind matching.
You weren't supposed to. But I think I can at least say what I think it is, and I think this is more of an experimental design type situation. At least this is where I believe it comes from, where you actually, you know, purposely pick matched samples of people, matched in terms of a range of demographics and other attributes, and then, you know, ask them the same questions or different questions, and, you know, infer that they're the same people. So I'm sorry, that's the extent of my knowledge.
Well, I think in the context I experienced, it was more to do with data protection. Like, for example, in America, in the work I was doing in the States, we might have a return path data set, and we've got people's names and addresses and their TV viewing. And there might be a company like Experian who've got people's purchasing habits, and data protection would not allow you to see at a respondent level what they're doing. So you send it off to a third party who adds the two things together and sends it back to you anonymized. So suddenly you end up with return part data, with shopping data, without you having broken any data protection laws in terms of seeing the addresses. So it's all more, I suspect the statistic behind it are pretty minimal. It's just a question of overlaying two data sets, seeing how many respondents are common, taking their names and addresses off and sending it back.
I think that's exactly right, and that's something then that would be in the domain of the real data scientist, I guess, at the end of the day.
Yeah, and not actually involving a huge amount of statistics. It's more just literally a Venn diagram of two data sets that you've got common respondents and you can overlay.
Well, now I understand what you're asking. I mean, it's obviously a very good way to put two data sets together if you're allowed to do it.
If you're allowed to do it,
Can I just touch on one more? Because there is this issue of ascription floating around as well. And I don't know if that's a bad word, because it doesn't seem to appear in any sort of stats-related dictionaries.
No.
But anyway, but I think that ascription is slightly different to imputation in that I think it's often associated with a requirement to calibrate a survey data set. And what you're trying to do is to use an ascription technique to create a respondent-level data set which matches the calibrated numbers that you're after at the end of the day. So you need to calculate how much you need to add or take away from a data set. The next thing you need to do is to identify which peoples in the data set are most deserving to receive that extra information or have it taken away. And you know, there's the classic example at the moment for me is the barb dovetail fusion.
Yeah.
And that's how it works.
So that's got a strong ascription element.
Strong ascription, yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to come on to that. We don't want to get into the sort of deep jungle of how dovetail is going to work, because, you know, that's an ongoing process. But there are a number of sort of fusion processes, ascription processes going on. We're aware of it happening in Holland, in Denmark. There's a number of countries ongoing. They've just launched a successful service in Singapore, taking in JFK, taking in different data sets. The US system increasingly with using ingesting Facebook data and so on.
Yeah.
So I want to talk at a broader level. Yeah, no, so I'm not going to get into the specifics of Barb, even though you probably wouldn't be able to talk about it anyway. But what are the? It strikes me that it's a bit of a balancing act between a number of key things that you've got to get right and the number of things that could go wrong. What would you say are the main challenges that if you're setting up a fusion and you're like an airline pilot with your dashboard in front of you? What are you looking for to make sure that it's worked, or what are the alarming red lights flashing to say it hasn't?
Okay, I mean if we start with the process itself, as we said, data fusion depends on matching the most similar respondents from each of the two survey data sets. A big issue that we always have is sample size, and the samples need to be big enough to represent the millions of different types of people that there are in the population, at least in respect to the subject of your fusion. And if you can't do that, you might be lost, you know, very much at the start. It's almost like having one survey's only got 16 to 34s on it and the other's only got 35 pluses. You can't really do a fusion.
Can't talk to each other.
The availability of fusion hooks is another really big issue, and it's a big issue for cross-media type fusions, and I think that extends to cross-platform type fusions.
To clarify, I mean, fusion hooks is something I've come across before, but it can be thrown about. But what do you mean by fusion hooks in terms of the... What purpose do they serve? How are they identified?
The fusion hooks are the things that enable you to identify that a person from one survey is pretty much the same as a person from another survey. So it'll be standard demographics. And standard demographics are fine, I believe, if you're doing a product survey linked to one media currency. If you're trying to cross media currencies, it doesn't work just with demographics. We know lifestyles come into play. And you probably need relevant fusion hooks, so which are actually, they might be called media imperatives, so a top-line skim over the subject of each of the survey, collected on both of the surveys, so you can cross-match. And, you know, this was the principle of the touch point.
And this is something you can do statistically. You can work out from a data set which are those parts of behaviour that best predict whether someone is going to have a such and such a media. So it's not just a qualitative thing. You can apply a change analysis or something like that.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is why I believe that what you really need for, if you're matching a separate online panel to a traditional TV panel, you do need to have a single source element somewhere along the line. Mm. And it's either a training data set to help you get these things right, to be able to identify the most important hooks to use in the fusion, or, and just as important, it's a validation tool, so that at some level you can actually check that the sense in the results that you're producing. Because this is what happens with fusion, the numbers that you want don't exist, so how the hell do you ever validate that it's okay? You have to have some single source.
Because if they did exist, you wouldn't be doing the fusion.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the other thing that... is a problem, and I think you've mentioned this to me before, Richard, is that panels do create a particular problem. If you're trying to fuse panels, you're doing it on a daily basis, people are joining and leaving the panel all the time, it means that a particular person in the Barb panel, say, is going to be given a different online viewer from day one to day two. You lose control of the autocorrelation in continuous viewing behaviour, and you get reach inflation.
Yeah, reach is the thing that seems to crop up a lot when it comes to fusion as a concern. The ability to work out whether someone's viewing, listening, readership is building up over time, which is obviously critical to advertisers, because the difference between reach and frequency drives the essence of what they're doing. How I think that is one of the major challenges, and to what degree can that be controlled, given, as you say, that you... in a lot of cases, you don't necessarily know what reach you're expecting.
Well, I think it can be controlled to a certain extent, particularly if you think about the Kantar Dovetail Fusion solution. Mm. They do specifically make an effort to actually put ceilings on reach build, and it's part of the ascription process. In the classic data fusion, it's a bit more difficult to do. But again, you know, it depends on effectively the segmentation that you're creating to drive the fusion. Now, I don't want to say that it's an absolutely huge problem. My experience in Italy, which I will talk about, is that there's, I'll call it small but systematic evidence of reach inflation. And, you know, we might have to deal with that, and we are in Italy, by having on-the-fly calibration procedures based on probability models that are applied by the Analysis Bureau, just to tidy things up at the end. But you just hit on an example where there's all these challenges from these types of fusions. You've got to generate demographic profiles of program audiences. That's the most important thing to do. The next most important thing is reach and frequency analysis. Mm. And something's got to give in the mix, basically.
And the other phrase you often come across as seen as a potential bear trap in fusions is what they sort of call regression to the mean.
Yeah.
Do you want to explain for our non-statistical because he often crops up. People say,
absolutely.
Oh, look, regression to the mean.
Oh, yeah. People like Ken Baker have made a living out of it. But really, regression...
Out of regressing to the mean or not regressing to
the mean. Measuring it.
Measuring regression.
But yeah, it's there. Regression to the mean is there in data fusion. It's there in all modelling techniques. And it's basically a softening of relationships. And as I said before, if you're doing a fusion between a product usage survey and a media survey, you probably don't get too much regression to the mean, because the demographics are very good at explaining real variations in media behaviour and product usage and as they interact. A cross-media one, you tend to have to accept that there is more regression to the mean in there.
But regression to the mean, effectively meaning things starting to become similar and bland, like a photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy.
Yeah. So if you're, you know, your 16 to 24 real index is, you know, 160, after you've done a data fusion and re-estimated it, it could be 140. Mm. So you've had a 20-point regression to the mean.
Mm. But everything's moving towards the average,
which is
the big concern, I guess.
Yeah.
Interesting stuff. So, without preempting too much what you're going to be talking about in Nice, it's in my session. We've got a number of papers on some fusions, and particularly on in the afternoon, we'll be looking at some of the more advanced systems that are starting to actually produce data. Mm. That's why we were keen to do a deep dive podcast into this, what may end up being a two-part podcast. We'll see how it gets edited. But I think it was important. But I think it was to set that context. Mm-hmm. Now, the work that you're doing in Italy, again, without giving too much away at this stage, or it may not be giving too much away because you may not have written the paper yet, because it's
something you know I haven't.
But do you want to give some context about what the mission was? So, I mean, how this cropped up and what they're actually trying to do out there.
Yeah, I'm not going to... I mean, I'm presenting with Davide Crestani from Auditel, and I don't want to blow on his boat, if you like, and he will be talking about the general development of the service in Italy. Mine is a very specific thing to address the reach inflation that we see in the new super panel. Mm. The new super panel was launched in August this year.
But super panel is what? Sorry, because it used to be the name for Kantar's thing in the UK, world panel. But this super panel is in Italy is what?
It's a hybrid of the existing 5,000 homes people meter panel, boosted with a 10,000 homes set meter only panel.
Okay, so it's a set meter panel. Yeah.
So the challenge for Auditel and for Nielsen, and I have to say that Nielsen have done a fantastic job, is to develop, evaluate and implement the individualization model, or we call it the person's viewing model. There's several names for it. And in terms of demographic profiles, obviously you're fighting against sampling error, this is why you're doing it. So you expect to see some change at the end of the day, which is always difficult to deal with, particularly when you're talking about large sampling error situations. But, you know, when you look at the more robust measurements, the more robust demographic profiles, you can see a logic in the way that they've changed, because you have a situation where there's evidence that there's more viewing homes containing the target demographic in the super panel. It justifies an increase. So all of that was absolutely fine, but we were still left with this small but systematic reach inflation effect that I was talking about. So it's how we deal with that I'm really going to concentrate on.
And is that producing, or is the aim for that to produce overnight? So every morning there's a new fuse data set out to the market?
Yes.
And that, obviously we know that's the case for Barb as well.
Yeah.
Does that, as a final point, because we talked at the top of the interview about the statisticians and data scientists and so on, it strikes me that one of the big developments now is the need to effectively weaponize or turn into a system that all the things we've been talking about, so that at 4 o'clock in the morning someone can press a button and have it all happen, and in most cases, unless something goes wrong, not have a human intervene and say, actually, this has gone wrong. Is that proving to be as much a challenge, the fact that you've got to do this every night in a fairly seamless way? Because things like touch points you've been involved in, presumably you had a certain amount of time to cogitate, think, you know, do iterations, come back. Yeah. But at the end of the day, Italy, the UK, presumably the ones that are also up and running in other markets, as things are happening on incredibly tight turnarounds in the small hours of the morning.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's an absolute demand for an expert system. And I can't deny that there won't be compromises to make sure that things actually don't fall over. So yes, it's a very difficult situation, and the idea is that you, at the end of the day, the user doesn't know almost, because it's just a transparent respondent level data set that looked the same as before, and that pops out. So it is an issue. I do have to acknowledge that with some of these on-the-fly calibration techniques and so on, and maybe some of the difficult constructs in these new data sets, we are putting a burden on the analysis bureau. And they have to take their share of the pain, if you like.
But you mean, companies like TechEdge and
some
of them are actually ingesting the data and having to work out how to take it into their system.
They already don't like people like us, Richard.
At the end of the day, the proof of whether all these have worked will be the lack of turbulence, in the sense that the end user carries on as normal, getting their data, is working okay. And then ironically, he's probably not that worried about what's going on at the surface. And I've used this analogy, I'm not sure I've used it in ASI cast before, that to a certain degree, particularly TV audience measurement, is a bit like flying a 747, in the sense that most people use it to get to A to B. They don't particularly know what's going on at the surface. They only really complain if there's turbulence. And so most of the time they're actually focused on whether the in-flight catering's any good or the peanuts are being delivered. Probably not that important stuff. The main important thing is that they're not crashing. So I guess the objective for all these new fusions is to have a system that doesn't experience turbulence, and ironically that the client doesn't notice at the end of the day, because they're noticing it, something's going wrong.
Absolutely, and I think you can apply that principle to the mainstream analyses that people have to do for their trading purposes or program evaluation purposes. However, the bottom line at the end of the day is someone from the industry who's developed these solutions has to give advice on how far you can push these data. That's the biggest danger we've got. Having created it, I now sort of want to stop people using it.
Or stop them misusing it.
Exactly, yeah.
Brilliant. Well, thanks for your time, Steve. And look forward to the paper in Nice.
See you in Nice.
You can listen to other ASI Cast interviews by accessing the archive of recordings at asiconferences.com.